This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, the British actor David Oyelowo, has often said he's learned about African-American history from the roles he's played. In the film Selma, he was Martin Luther King. In The Butler, he was the son who was active in the civil rights movement and became a Black Panther. In Red Tails, he was one of the Tuskegee Airmen. Oyelowo was born in England to parents who immigrated from Nigeria. After facing racism in England, Oyelowo's parents decided to return to Nigeria, where Oyelowo lived for several years before moving back to England, where he had to adjust to becoming a member of a minority group again. He found his calling when he discovered acting. At 24, Oyelowo became the first Black actor to play a king in a Royal Shakespeare Company production. Oyelowo currently stars in the HBO movie Nightingale, a single-character drama in which he portrays a veteran living in his mother's home, having a mental breakdown. In this scene, he wants to invite one of his military friends to dinner, but he's afraid of getting rejected, so he rehearses what he's going to say.
Pick up the phone, make the call, just make the call. Just call him. Later. It's Peter.
I know, man. It's been too long. It's great to hear your voice.
There's been a change of circumstances around here, and I just
love to have you over for dinner. You know, no big deal. Just a nice meal and some conversation. And no, you can't bring anything. Just yourself. I swear, if you try to bring something, I will kick your ass. I just want you to come over for a nice, well-cooked meal for once in your life. Will you do that for me, please? It's too bossy. Hello, Edward. It's Peter Snowden.
Hello, Edward.
Hello, Edward.
It's Peter Snowden. I know. It's been too long.
Yeah, I miss you too, man.
That's David Oyelowo in a scene from Nightingale, which will be shown on HBO Friday, May 29th. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Thank you. My pleasure.
I like that scene because you're testing out different styles of speaking to this man who you really want to get in touch with and who's been trying not to get in touch with you. So, I mean, here you are as a British actor putting on a different voice for that and then having to go further and testing out different styles of speaking in this scene. So can you talk about the style of speaking, the type of American accent you gave this character, if there's anybody in particular or any region in particular that you based it on?
Well, you know, when I got the script for Nightingale, I mean, the fact of the matter is that Peter Snowden wasn't written as African-American. But when I read it, I felt here is an opportunity to play the kind of African-American that I've certainly encountered in having lived here now for 8 years, but I very rarely see in cinema. And this is a guy who is an introvert. He's a bit of a nerd. He's agoraphobic, doesn't like leaving the house. There's nothing outward about him. And so that's got to be, I wanted that to be reflected in his voice. He also has, you know, he has an odd relationship with his sexuality. I would argue that he's gay, but he's in denial about that fact. And that's to do with repression that comes from having been in the military, a religious upbringing that flies in the face of that. And so I wanted a voice that didn't sort of have any lyricism to it. I wanted it to be a little bit whiny, a little bit annoying.
You're playing somebody in Nightingale who is becoming unhinged. And you're doing this after having played Martin Luther King, who is bearing so much weight on his shoulders and has to hold himself and a whole movement together. Did you have some pleasure in playing somebody who's becoming unhinged after carrying the burden of playing King?
Well, funnily enough, I actually shot Nightingale before Selma. I know that Selma, or the performance I gave in Selma, was definitely affected by having done something as demanding as Nightingale. you know, for me, I made the choice, and it was the first time I've done it in my career, whereby I felt I had to stay in character the whole time. I just felt, you know, a guy who is this in his own head and who is this mentally unstable, I just couldn't see the world in which I was coming in and out of character on set. And so I made that choice. And I think I wouldn't have made the choice to do the same thing in Selma if I hadn't gained the confidence having done it in Nightingale. I did two films, Last King of Scotland and Lincoln, both of which I was acting opposite phenomenal actors who did stay in character the whole time, in the shape of Forrest Whitaker in Last King of Scotland and Daniel Day-Lewis in Lincoln. And the results are undeniable, but you know, personally, I would always feel a bit pretentious about going around saying, oh, by the way, everyone's got to call me Idi Amin, or everyone's got to call me President Lincoln. You know, but that's just my own thing for me. But when you're just the only actor and a very small crew in one house, you can kind of do it without feeling too sort of self-conscious. But the benefit of doing it was that I never second-guessed my choices as an actor. Every decision I make in Nightingale felt rooted in who that man is, and I wanted that same element in playing Dr. King.
So when you say that you stayed in character for Nightingale and Selma, does that mean when you were on the set, or does that mean like you came home and you were still in character, or at the very least still speaking as an American?
I stayed in character for the 3 weeks we shot Nightingale and for the 3 months we shot Selma. Ava would call me out of the blue at times just to check.
Because Ava DuVernay, the director.
Ava DuVernay. Just to check that I think she was shocked that I was going to go through with this. I mean, this is how bad it got, is that I remember my wife, we were moving house at the time. And my wife called me and said, "So what do you think? Should we go for the grey curtains or the brown?" And I literally went, "Well, I think we should." And she went, "Stop, stop! I cannot talk curtains with Dr. King. We're gonna pick this up afterwards. What on earth are you doing?" And so, that was the moment I thought, "Oh, okay, I am all the way in here." But yes, you know, I just felt for me. You can't half do Dr. King, and we were shooting in Atlanta. You know, I'm a British guy. I can't go around talking like this. You know, it's not just about doing a good job. It's about eliciting confidence in people around me that I can take this great man and do him justice.
So you became famous in the United States for Selma. I think you were already well known in England for your performances. And in Selma, you didn't do an impersonation of King, but you still had to evoke King. So I want to play a scene from Selma in which you, as Martin Luther King, you're speaking at a church in Selma, Alabama, talking about the need to organize around the right to vote.
As long as I am unable to exercise my constitutional right to vote, I do not have command of my own life. I cannot determine my own destiny, for it is determined for me by people who would rather see me suffer than succeed. Those that have gone before us say, no more, no more. That means protest, that means march, that means disturb the peace, that means jail, that means risk, and that is hard. We will not wait any longer. Give us the vote.
That's right. No more.
We're not asking, we're demanding. Give us the vote.
So my guest David Oyelowo as Martin Luther King in a scene from Selma. So how did you study King's cadences so that without impersonating him, you could still get the music of his speech kind of correctly, you know, in an evocative way?
Yeah.
Like, you have that line in there, and it was probably written by Ava DuVernay because of rights issues, you couldn't actually use King's speeches. So there's a line in there in the scene that we heard where King refers to people who'd rather see me suffer than succeed. Now, if I was saying that, I'd probably refer to people who'd rather see me suffer than succeed. But the way you say it, it's like people who'd rather see me suffer than succeed. And the accent is on the than. And so it's a really interesting choice in my mind. I could definitely imagine King saying it that way. So what made you make that choice to put the accent on the than? Rather see me suffer than succeed.
Because that's what he did. I studied his cadence to the point whereby you understand that sometimes he used very, to be perfectly frank, bizarre emphasis. Because you're right, it's not your normal delivery. And your average person wouldn't necessarily know that. But for me, as someone who's studied his cadence, I know that it's only if I hit some of his idiosyncrasies in terms of the way he spoke that you will overall feel like you are watching Dr. King. You know, Ava and I broke down every single speech and, you know, we put in the rule of three, which he used a lot of the time. He would posit an idea at the beginning, refer to it in the middle, and then bring it home at the end. These were all things that we wove into speeches that weren't words that he spoke, but are evocative of the speeches he gave, because there is a music to the way he gave a speech. If you've listened to every single one of those speeches, which I pretty much have, there is a very clear, like any musician, like any composer, you know, there is a signature style, and that signature style can be transposed, and that's what we did with the speeches. And that phrase you referenced there is classic King.
Your parents are from Nigeria. You were born in England and spent the first few years of your life there. But then your parents decided to return to Nigeria, taking, of course, you with them. So can you tell us a little bit about why they first came to England and then why they decided to return to Nigeria?
Well, you know, Nigerians, generally speaking, academia is one of the big aims, is one of the big ambitions you have. And so my dad, and that tends to be something that certainly for my dad's generation was something to procure from the West. And so my dad came to the UK. He was in Oxford wanting to have this sort of highfalutin education. He fell in love with my mum, who was my uncle's secretary, his brother's secretary, but she was Igbo and he is Yoruba. He comes from a royal family. She is a pleb, so to speak. and so basically they kind of eloped to the UK because Yoruba and Igbo marrying was a bit of a taboo, especially as like I say, he was from a royal family. So there were a number of reasons why they ended up in the UK. But things just got a little tricky, you know, racism existed and of course still exists, but, you know, was more stark back in the 70s and 80s. And my parents just felt I think our opportunities would be better in Nigeria, but we went back to Nigeria, and soon afterwards a military government came in that made life even more difficult. So we ended up coming back to the UK when I was about 13.
So, again, like you were born in England, then moved to Nigeria, where your family was from when you were around six, spent several years there, then moved back to England. And you've said that when you moved back to England from Nigeria, that your black peers in school called you a coconut, which is the equivalent of an Oreo in America, black on the outside, white on the inside. It's a pretty major insult. And it strikes me as so odd that you'd be called that, because you had just come from Africa, where your parents are from, and what is blacker than African, right? I mean, we call, you know, black people in America are referred to as African American because there's a sense of pride from having African roots. And so to be insulted for ways of behaving that stem in part from being born of African parents just strikes me as so odd. But let's hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's born out of, again, it's linked to what I said before. If your notion of what it is to be black has been tarnished by what the culture in which you live in projects onto you, then you have a cankered sense of what that means. In the UK, the reason I was being called a coconut is because to be black in the inner city school that I was going to was to be abusive to the teachers, to be getting as many girls pregnant as you possibly can, to be in trouble with the law. These were all things that were badges of honor where I grew up in North London. And so to be a kid who wore his uniform correctly, who was respectful to his teachers, who put his head down and did his work, you know, somehow I was trying to be something other than what I am supposed to be. And you're right, it really confused me, because here I am, literally having just come back from the so-called motherland, and I had other people who looked like me saying that I was trying to not be what it is to be black. But that's because they had taken on a false notion of what that should mean and what that does mean. But it was also a notion that was being projected onto them by the society in which they live. You know, criminality is somehow linked to being black. Teenage pregnancy is linked to being black. You know, things that are negative are linked to being black. And they were taking it on. And I absolutely refused to do that because I knew it not to be true. And that's what I would refer to as a minority mentality. It's a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy of being the thing that the larger society says you are. And you know, to a certain degree, you have a bit of that in American culture as well, unfortunately.
What were some of the consequences, if there were any, that you faced for sticking to who you were as opposed to trying to be what other people in your school projected you ought to be?
Well, I got bullied. I would go home and I'd take my blazer off, and there was, you know, I'd been spat at, and I'd see dry spit that was clearly on my back all day. And, you know, I remember one time I was beaten up in the toilets by a guy who literally, you know, a black guy who literally cornered me in the toilets and said, "You think you're better than me, don't you?" And then punched me in the face. And I had to have a few days off school because my jaw swole up and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, a few years later, I was driving in the same area and I saw that very same guy being chased down the street by the police. You know, and it's this unfortunate self-fulfilling prophecy of that syndrome. I mean, there was a very clear attempt to make me come away from what I knew to be true for me, which is that achievement and getting ahead in life is absolutely rooted in hard work. You know, if I were less strong-willed, if I had parents who were less supportive, maybe I would have taken on those lies. But thankfully for me, I didn't.
Was it considered controversial to cast you?
It was. And in all honesty, when I was cast, I had no idea that I was the first black person to be afforded that opportunity at the RSC. And to be honest, I kind of tried to ignore it, but it wouldn't go away. It was constantly in the press. It was, you know, there was one point at which I was rehearsing and I spent all of my lunch breaks fielding questions from the press. And, you know, we just kind of needed, at some point we had to shut it down because the director didn't cast me to elicit that kind of reaction. I don't think he was even aware. But, you know, thankfully the plays were incredibly well received and that whole thing went away and was sort of replaced by how well the plays were realized.
So after getting some good roles in England in television, movies, Royal Shakespeare Company, in 2007 you moved to the United States. Why did you want to come to L.A.?
Because the actors that I truly admired, the actors who I deemed to be at the zenith, the height of what I do for a living, were doing work in Hollywood. You know, Daniel Day-Lewis was working in Hollywood, as was Sean Penn, as was Denzel Washington, as had Sidney Poitier. And so therefore, I just felt like where I was wasn't going to get me to what I aspired to. And so it was very much motivated by that.
It's funny you should mention Sidney Poitier, because in The Butler, your character, who's a civil rights activist who gets disillusioned with nonviolence and becomes a more militant Black Panther, he's arguing with his parents about Sidney Poitier. You know, your mother in a play by Oprah Winfrey is a big fan, and you're saying, no, he's really, he's just acting like white people want Black people to behave.
Mm. That's the hardest line I've ever had to say
in
a
movie,
ever. Oh my goodness. I stewed over that so much because, you know, he literally is my hero. You know, but the rationale, and I spoke to Lee Daniels, our director, about it a lot, and his rationale was it was an attitude and an opinion held by a lot of Black people at that time is that, I mean, for some reason there was this notion that Sidney Poitier was an Uncle Tom or whatever. But I think, to be perfectly honest, I think it's a little bit of what I experienced with the coconut thing, is that, you know, to be Black means a certain way of being, a certain way of speaking, a certain way of behaving, and then to be white means something else. And if you are not all the way Black, then you must be edging towards being white in some way. And I, so, you know, but like I say, that was a that was a tough day of shooting for me.
So we actually have a scene in which you say that line about Sidney Poitier. So
we
actually have that picked out. So let me just set it up.
Dear.
So you've been through every phase of the civil rights movement. You play the son of a butler who's worked at the White House serving 8 presidents. And he's a, you know, a pretty conservative man. And you've protested in Freedom Riders, you've protested at lunch counters, you know, protesting for integration, you've marched with Martin Luther King, now you're a Black Panther in it. This is your first time home visiting your parents in 7 years. You've brought your girlfriend with you. She has this huge afro. You're wearing the kind of beret that the Black Panthers wore. Your father's so upset when you're describing why you've become a Panther. And your mother, played by Oprah Winfrey, tries to change the subject. Here we go.
Me and your daddy saw a wonderful movie the other night. Reminded me so much of you.
Oh, yeah?
What was the name of that movie, honey?
In the Heat of the Night.
In the Heat of the Night with Sidney Poitier? Lord, Sidney Poitier. I love Sidney Poitier.
Sidney Poitier is a white man's fantasy of what he wants us to be.
But his movies have him fight for equal rights.
Only in a way that's acceptable to the white status quo. The brother can't act.
What are you talking about? He just won the Academy Award. He's breaking down barriers for all of us.
By being white. By acting white. Sidney Poitier is nothing but a rich Uncle Tom.
Look at you. You're all puffed up. Put your hat on your head. Coming in here. Saying whatever you want. Girlfriend belching at the table. You don't even feel you gotta go to school even though I gave you the money. You need to go. Yeah. Lewis. You need to get out of my house.
What?
Get the hell out of my house!
What are you doing?
No. Get on out!
Cecil,
you gotta go.
Cecil, no.
I can't take this no more.
We ain't seen this boy in 7 years now. Everybody just
sit down. Sorry, Mr. Butler. I didn't mean to make fun of your hero.
Everything you are and everything you have is because of that butler. Now you take that trifling, low-class bitch and get out of this house.
Okay, a scene from The Butler with my guest David Oyelowo as the son who's joined the Black Panthers, Forrest Whitaker as his father who's the White House butler, Oprah Winfrey as the mother. So did it make you uncomfortable to hear that argument about Sidney Poitier?
Very. the worst is when I say Sidney Poitier can't act. I mean, oh my Lord, what's he talking about? But like I say, look, the truth for him was that, and the great thing about but playing Lewis in that film was to watch his development from effectively a boy to an old man. I mean, that was it's the kind of opportunity I was afforded when I played Henry VI. Almost never happens in movies, and you know, that was a point in his development. I'm almost certain that as we saw that character progress through the film, it wasn't an opinion he kept on holding about the great Sidney Poitier.
So you've done pretty well in America with your acting career, but was it hard at first before you established yourself? Because you had two things, you know, that could have held you back. One was just being black. There's fewer black roles than white roles in America, mm-hmm. and there isn't that much colorblind casting, particularly for leading roles. And number two is you're making movies in America, but you have a British accent. We've all learned how convincing you are with various kinds of American accents, but you hadn't proven that yet when you got here. So what was it like for you? What kind of roles were you offered?
It was very difficult to begin with, if I'm honest. And, you know, my wife and I made the choice to sell up in the UK. We wanted to take away any kind of safety net because we knew that tough times would come and we didn't want to feel tempted to get back on the boat and leave before we'd given it a really good go. But what we couldn't have anticipated is after moving here in 2007 that there would be an economic crash and a writer's strike. That would mean that no one... I know. I can laugh now. It wasn't funny at the time, but, you know, and that basically meant no one was working. So, you know, that was a very tough period. But, you know, I'm a big believer in tenacity and you know, sticking it out. And, you know, certain opportunities came along that built on other opportunities. And, you know, it's a cliche, but it's true. But good work begets good work. And I took smaller roles, but tried to be as good as I can be in each and every one of them. And it sort of built from there.
Did you turn down roles that you didn't want to do?
Always. You know, I would much, much rather, you know, work in a supermarket than take any role that I didn't believe in. I've never, ever taken a role for money purposes or for some bizarre notion of what may be the kind of career move that would open things up for me. If I don't believe in it, I can't do it because I won't be good in it if I don't believe in it.
Is there an example of a kind of role that you've turned down? I realize you might not want to mention by name a specific film or a specific role, but...
Well, you know, roles that basically feed into a kind of stereotype of what it is to be black. Don't send me your script if you want me to play the black best friend. I just won't do that.
What if it's a really interesting best friend?
But then it's not the black best friend. Then there will be other ways to describe that character. But you can feel when it's literally an afterthought. You can mm-hmm. feel when it's like, oh, quick, let's get some color in here. You know, that I won't do because it's disrespectful. And I, you know, for me, I'm either part of the solution or I'm part of the problem. So I won't do that. I won't do roles that I deemed to be stereotypical or caricatures of what it is to be black or even just to be a human being. I won't do that. I hate horror. I don't like horror films. I don't really personally see the value in them. You know, also anything that basically is overtly celebrating darkness and to be perfectly honest, sanctioning it. That's something I can't personally do. I feel you cannot see the light without darkness, but for me, a prerequisite I have for myself is that light must eventually win out, and that's just what I choose to put out into the world. I believe in it. I know that films affect and shape culture, and I want to put stuff in the world that I feel is edifying as opposed to stuff that is detrimental.
David Oyelowo stars in the HBO movie Nightingale. If you'd like to hear a longer version of our conversation, check out Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair. The Cannes Film Festival, the largest and most important international film festival, wrapped up on May 24th. The festival, which is held in Cannes on the French Riviera, is a tradition that dates back to 1946, the year after World War II ended. Our critic at large, John Powers, attended the festival, as he usually does, and he's going to tell us about the best films he saw there and some of the worst films he sat through. John Powers also writes about film and TV for Vogue and Vogue.com. John, welcome back to the show. It's always good to talk with you about Cannes. Let's start with the film that won the top prize. It's directed by Jacques Audiard, who did a film I like a lot called Rust and Bone, and he also did a film called A Prophet, which I did not see. But tell us about this new one.
Yes, the film is a film called Dipan, and it's a film that's a cross between a social drama and a thriller. It's set in Sri Lanka at the beginning, and it shows three Sri Lankans, a guerrilla fighter, a woman he meets along the way, and a child they pick up, who pretend to be a refugee family in order to get asylum in France. But when they move to France, they're put in a housing project that turns out to be run by drug people, so that in fact they've gone from what seems like Eastern squalor and misery and civil war to the terrors of Western civilization. And the story sort of follows their progress as they try to make their way to survive in an alien landscape. It's a very good film, maybe a little violent at the end, but the strange thing about it in festival terms was that I don't think anyone thought it would win. It was a film that people liked, and they all thought, oh, that's a nice film, and that might win some prize, but no one thought it would win the overall prize.
Were you disappointed that it won?
Well, I was disappointed only that I had a favorite that I wish had won. But, you know, but it's a good film. And ODR is a filmmaker who's been around about 20 years, has made lots of good things. And I think he's the kind of person who would appeal in particular to the jury heads, who are the brothers Joel and Ethan Coen from the United States, because he makes, in a sense, old-style movies that are nicely structured, well put together, have a storyline that you can that engages you and you can follow, and is commercial, and yet at the same time deals with tricky and complicated things. I think that's more or less, I think, what the Coens think they're doing, which is to use commercial cinema with stories that people can follow to tell stories that a lot of other people wouldn't.
Let's move to the film that won Best Director.
This is a film that I love so extravagantly that I will probably babble to you.
Is this the film you referred to before as the film you wish had won the top prize?
Oh, this is the film that I wish had won, yes. Uh-huh. It's called The Assassin. It was described initially as a martial arts film by the Taiwanese director Ho Xiao-shin. And there is probably less martial arts fighting in it than in any martial arts film in history. What it basically is set in the 9th century Tang Dynasty, and is the story of a young woman assassin, played by the beautiful Taiwanese actress Shu Qi, who is sent back to her hometown to kill the prince to whom she was once betrothed. And that's the plot, and the question is, will she do it or not? The film unfolds very, very slowly in some of the most exquisite shots I've ever seen in my life. I mean, the thing that... Perhaps the most striking single thing at Cannes this year was how quiet the audience was watching the film. The level of artistry was so much higher than anything else in the festival that everyone was, in one way or another, ravished. The worst that people could say about it was they couldn't follow the plot or that it was too beautiful. It is incredibly uncommercial. It's slow. It's difficult to follow. It's so refined and rarefied that maybe one person in 25 would like it. But for that person, they would always think it's the best film. And in this case, I did. It's a masterful film.
John, the Best Actress Award actually went to two actresses, to Rooney Mara, who became famous for her performance in the American adaptation of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And she's in a new movie directed by Todd Haynes called Carol. And the other actress who won was Emmanuelle Bercot, who was in a film called Moon Roi, which translates to My King. So tell us about the film that Rooney Mara won for.
Well, for a long time, the film that Rooney Mara was in, which is called Carol, was everybody's idea of the front runner for the whole festival. It was made by Todd Haynes, who people will know from directing Far From Heaven and the HBO series Mildred Pierce. And it's kind of in that tradition of a period melodrama. In this case, Rooney Mara plays a shop girl working at a department store who meets an older, highly done-up, and to my mind, slightly scary woman named Carol, played by Kate Blanchett in full ferocious Kate Blanchett-ness mode. And the two fall in love. Because this is the 1950s, that's not a good thing. And it's basically about what happens to the two of them. From the opening day it showed, it was the film to beat. And yet it only won for Rooney Mara, who basically won, I think, because she seemed human and warm and open in a film that was often maybe too studied and a little, the universe felt a little hermetic. And she was the most vibrant thing in it, to my mind. That Blanchett was so purely what she was, she almost seemed like a mask in a no drama. And Rooney Mara was giving a more, I think, American Hollywood-style performance.
What was the most divisive film at the festival? You know, Cannes, people actually boo at the Cannes Film Festival. People are very demonstrative about their opinions. They don't sit silently, from all I've been told. So what were people arguing about?
Well, strangely enough, the film they argued about the most was, I guess, what you'd call a women's picture or a melodrama about a lawyer played by a woman named Emmanuelle Bercot, who also won, split the Best Actress prize with Rooney Mara from the film Carol. And she's a lawyer, divorced, and she falls in love with this very enticing, charming, witty, sexy man played by the French actor Vincent Cassel, who seems born to play enticing, sexy, witty men who, in the end, you realize you shouldn't have trusted. And that's exactly what happens here. And the film basically follows their relationship. And it's the classic woman's picture nightmare film where you've fallen in love with somebody you think is fabulous and you realize that you've made a mistake. But, you know, he's still a lot of fun to be with. The sex is still good. And weirdly enough, once you get married and have a kid, he's actually a good father. The problem is he's also irresponsible. You can't trust him. He's bad with money. And the film is that kind of film, but shot in a way that's filled with extravagant scenes. And so I know that Americans didn't like it very much. The Brits really hated it. I think that their idea of hell is being caught in a room with emotional French people. And and this was a film filled with emotional French people. And yet the film is really alive in lots of ways. It goes on way too long, but it does capture better than lots of other things that feeling of falling for someone you know is bad for you and not being able to resist it. The guy who plays the guy who's bad for you is Vincent Cassel, who's really tremendous. It's the best he's been in years and years and years and years. And then the actress Emmanuelle Bercot is giving this extravagant performance where she does laugh and she cries and she strips and she makes love and she has a baby and she cries some more and she laughs and then she looks for closure. She even hobbles around because she hurts herself while skiing. You know, it's one of those performances where she does everything. And that's the kind of performance that people used to do in Hollywood movies. And this is like a modern French riff on an old-fashioned Hollywood movie. It made some people crazy, and other people thought it's a mess but really great. I was in the it's a mess but really great school. But, you know, most of my friends were in this school of can't this stop? You know, I would slap these people if I could. Normally, I'm a great slapper myself of fictional characters, but in this case, I was with it.
Vincent Cassel, who's the male lead in it, he's great. I saw him in Black Swan. He was the ballet teacher, and in Eastern Promises, he was a gangster from, was it the Soviet Union, from Russia? Soviet,
and he's really great in Eastern Promises.
Yeah.
I always love watching him, and usually, you know, he's one of those actors of such incredible force that movies don't do him justice because they're always asking him to play an ordinary person. Whereas here he's playing more than that. I mean, I guess it would be like in the way that in the old days, if you ask Jack Nicholson to play an accountant, you'd be wasting Jack Nicholson-ness. In Vincent Cassel's case, he's often asked to play things that don't call on everything he can do. This film really does. So this is one of those rare movies where the guy who's bad for you is supposed to be so sexy and charming that you like him anyway. And in this film, he's so sexy and charming, you like him anyway. And she really seems to like him. She's terrific, too.
So what got the most boos this year at the Cannes Film Festival?
Yes. Well, the most booed and most happily booed was a film by Gus Van Sant, who's actually won the festival in years gone by, in a film starring Matthew McConaughey as a guy who flies to a famous forest in Japan in order to commit suicide. The film is called The Sea of Trees, and he's surrounded by a sea of trees and is about to kill himself when he meets a Japanese guy who's wounded and lost in the forest. He's played by the wonderful Japanese actor Ken Watanabe. And then
who's now on Broadway in The King and I.
Who's now on Broadway, yes. And what happens is they start talking, and McConaughey begins explaining why his life is why he wanted to take his own life. And you flash back to his life that caused this. He was married unhappily to Naomi Watts, and you see scenes of that. And then gradually, as the film unfolds, there are tricks and surprises and sentimental bits of hooey that were so flabbergasting. The film was a bit like a cross between The Sixth Sense and what else? A Hallmark card with a little bit of New Age rubbish thrown in. And the audience sat in disbelief because Van Sant is often a very rigorous and refined director. And this was the kind of stuff that most Hollywood people would think, oh, we can't do that. It's too shameless. And nobody walked out because it was so shockingly bad. Everyone thought there must be something that's going to happen, you know, that we're going to wake up and think it was all a dream because it can't be this bad. The person sitting next to me said, I wanted to walk out, but I wanted to stay to hear the booze. And in fact, at the end, the place roared with booze. It got the lowest ranking of critics' rankings that I've ever seen a film get in the history of Cannes.
I feel it is my duty to ask you if you saw the 3D porn movie that played at Cannes.
I did see it. Actually, I didn't see all of it because I did walk out of it. It is a 3D porn film that does what you might expect a 3D porn film does. And I won't explain that, but you can perhaps imagine it. And it is made by a filmmaker named Gaspar Noé, who's made some interesting films in the past. In this case, it's a film, a very boring film, based on his own life, about a guy torn between being stuck with his wife and kid, which he doesn't like, and remembering the hot, sexy babe he had great sex with. And essentially the film is about that, played by actors who aren't very good. And the reason they're not very good is because they're doing hardcore sex sequences. It's one of those films that you would be called controversial, I guess, if anyone had liked it. But the truth is, no one liked it. It's a bad film. It doesn't add anything interesting to either 3D or pornography or to our understanding of love. You know, he's made some films in the past that I've liked very much and that were controversial, you know, because they would be saying things about politics or they would be showing family relationships in a way that people found disturbing. In this particular case, the only controversy, I guess, is the one they're trying to trump up because it's so audacious to shoot a 3D art movie that's filled with pornography.
There's a documentary about the singer Amy Winehouse, the late Amy Winehouse, that's opening in the States in July. It showed at Cannes, so you just got to see it. What did you think of it?
The film about Amy Winehouse is a very good film. I didn't know all that much about her. I mean, I knew she could sing. I knew her basic sad story. I knew that she died. But I didn't know the story nearly as well as the British people there did, because I think they'd been following it for years. It's made by a guy named Asif Kapadia.
Yeah, and I just want to interject here. Like, her really big hit was Rehab.
Rehab.
And she was in and out of rehab a lot and then died of drug-related
yes.
causes.
And alcohol-related.
And
yes,
alcohol, yeah.
At age 27. What's striking about the film is that usually when you get stories of doomed pop stars, they seem exploitative and crummy. And they don't show you the stuff, but you spend a lot of time talking to people saying vaguely portentous things with a little bit of music in the background. But you don't really have a sense that you understood what went on. In this particular case, there's an incredible amount of footage of Amy Winehouse from the time she was 14 years old. So we meet her on screen before she is a professional singer, just singing at a friend's party. And she's so fresh and young and cheeky and alive that you're drawn to her right away. And as you watch the whole film, you never see a talking head. It's all footage of her either performing or behaving. And the director talked to 100 people about her. Their testimony, you hear it, with a little label saying who's talking. But you gradually watch her story unfold as they tell you the story. And it's a terrible story because she is this wonderful, talented young woman who destroys herself in about 10 years. And very few of the people around her do enough to try to help her. This is partly because she could be difficult. It's partly because she had a taste for lousy men. It's partly because her parents weren't as protective of her as they should be. It's partly because she was under contract to give concerts that she shouldn't have given, and people made her had her go ahead and do those concerts even when she should have gone to rehab. And it's partly because there's a huge self-destructive part of her that couldn't stop doing the things that would destroy her. This film is one of those rarest of tabloid-sounding things, which is a compassionate film.
So some of the films at Cannes were controversial, some of them were booed, but one of the most controversial things that happened at Cannes happened on the red carpet, where women were banned unless they wore high heels. Can you explain what that rule is?
You know, the red carpet is designed to be this glamorous thing, so that for the evening screenings, when people go up the red carpet, they're supposed to be dressed in formal wear. What that means is men are supposed to be wearing black tie, and women are supposed to be in gowns and high heels. Some women got turned away for wearing flats, sometimes in preposterous circumstances. Women who were quite old and for whom it would be quite dangerous to walk up the red carpet in high heels were turned away. A couple of people with medical conditions that didn't allow them to wear high heels were turned away. And some other women were just turned away for wearing flats. This prompted one of those great Cannes controversies, because you have so many media people there that if something goes awry, there are so many people that cover it and they won't let the story drop, because there's a level of frenzy that's always going on there. In this case, it was all the funnier, I guess, because at the beginning it was clear that Cannes was really wanting to make this the year of the woman. In 2014, the festival had gotten pilloried for seeming to have no women in the competition and paying no attention to female filmmakers. So this year they opened with a film by a French woman. A great number of the films were about female characters. There were special panels, you know, outside the festival, but the festival was supporting, about the role of women in film. They were doing all this stuff to show that, despite what you might think, Cannes really loves women. And the one story that broke out of Cannes is how you have to wear high heels on the red carpet.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large and writes about film and TV for Vogue and Vogue.com. You'll find a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews were produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.